Session number 788, Kenneth Cooper, Reel 1 of 4.
What part of the country were you brought up in?
I was born in Cardiff and went to prep school there. Then I went to public school at Berkhamsted in Hertfordshire. Then I left that because my father lost a certain amount of money in the First World War, and my elder brother, or one of my elder brothers, had to go to Cambridge, and so I had to leave public school at about 16.
I see. Were you a big family?
5 of us.
Where did you come in the pecking order?
I was the last.
I see. The baby. Yes. And your father, what sort of business was he in?
My grandfather went from London to South Wales to build the Taffville Railways. And my father was brought up on railways. And then he lost a lot of money because they built some railways in Spain too. And they've only got paid in government bonds or whatever they were, which weren't worthless. So at the age of about 23, my father had to start earning a living, which he did, and he went into railways and became chief accountant of the Taffville Railway.
I see. And you went to prep school and to public school at Berkhamsted?
Yes.
How'd you get on at school? Were you a good scholar?
No. I was never a good scholar, better at games.
Yeah.
I think, as regards scholar, perhaps I was a bit mentally idle.
And Berkhamsted, did it have an army class?
Oh, yes. It had had a very good OTC. In those days, it was called an OTC. Indeed, it was one of the few OTCs who had the reputation of always marching to camp in the summer. When they went to this camp, it was a rote march the whole way wherever it was.
What kind of distances did that involve?
Oh, 60-100 miles. You stopped the night, bivouacked on the way in a hall, drill hall, or not, as the case may be.
Yes. You had a year at Cambridge yourself, at Emmanuel College, before you went into the army. What were you studying, and why was it only a year?
I was studying history, and it was only a year because I failed my exams, my interim exams, and it was a waste of time going on. And so instead of getting into the army through the university, my parents sent me to a military crammer, and I took the Sandhurst passing out exam and got my regular commission from that. As of course I had been, at that time, I'd been a territorial army officer for, I suppose, about 3 years. Mm.
This military crammer interests me. Was it a school purely for the purpose of cramming for the Sandhurst entry?
He was a retired Indian Army colonel in Ealing, and he used to take youngsters either for the Staff College, either for Sandhurst, or for any military exams that anybody wanted to go in for.
Yes, I see. Your experience with the territorials, where was that?
This was in Cardiff, the 53rd Welsh Divisional Signals, and in those days, of course, we had the old horses and cable wagons, and it was a tremendous experience.
Why?
Well, you got a group of volunteers who were very keen on their work, and apart from the drills during the winter months, then you look forward to the fortnight summer camp when you went out and you worked hard during the daytime and played hard at night.
How did you decide on a service career? What led up to it?
Oh, I think it was very largely the effect of the territorial experience. And also because, as I say, I left school at 16 and I went into an office in Cardiff where I was for, till I got into, got my commission. I was in this office and I didn't think much of office life. Wasn't my cup of tea at all.
Did the territorials experience have any bearing on your choice of the RTC as the corps that you joined?
No, I don't think so. Not very much. I rarely joined the RTC, the Tank Corps, Royal Tank Corps, because I would have preferred to join the cavalry, but I couldn't afford it. And secondly, of course, I liked the role of the cavalry. It seemed to me, in a very youthful way, that the answer was, well, then if I can't do it that way by horses, there is this modern tank, which I'd read about and had seen a little bit from the OTC days, I think, that I thought, well, let's go for this modern new regiment, which must have a tremendous spirit and a tremendous challenge to build up.
Did you do a little bit of research into the Corps before you made up your mind?
Not really, not to any depth, only talking to people. Mm. No, nothing further than that. I didn't go and visit any of the regiments, or in those days they were called battalions. I didn't do anything like that. But I did talk to a lot of elderly and military people about it and discussed it with them.
And as a result of your conversations with them, did you get any impressions about the sort of status of the tank corps within the army at that time, as compared with the other arms?
No, except that it was a new arm, or rather not a new arm, but a new corps, which was building itself up. And I think it was probably true to say that I heard it mentioned that it was against great odds, because, of course, anything modern in those days in the army was rather frowned upon. People didn't like changing. And so one realized that it was a challenge to go into, but one had also got the very definite feeling that the people who had formed and fought in the First World War were a jolly fine lot of chaps and had done a marvelous thing to build up the spirit of this new corps, which became the new corps, the Royal Tank Corps. And I also got a certain amount of that also from my brother, who was eldest brother, who was in the First World War as a Royal Engineer, and he was not connected, he didn't fight with the tanks, but he was in the same battles and saw them, how they worked.
So your brother was a relevant figure in
oh, very much
coming
so.
To this decision.
Brother was, yes.
When you joined the 5th Battalion at Perham Down in 1927, and went there, Did the fact that it was still a relatively new core, was that apparent from what you found when you got there? I mean, did it have the feeling of being a new core?
Oh, no, I don't think so. It. I went there, and I didn't know anybody there. I just had to report on a certain day, and I went into the orderly room and reported, and I was immediately accepted and taken over to and shown round my quarters and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And another young officer was told to look after me, and one fell into it rather like going to a new school.
What was Perham Down actually like when you went there?
Perham Down, when I went there, was just simply a series of tin huts on the above Tidworth, on the open high ground, bleak in the winter, and very windswept. But again, it had, in a way, I think, and especially for a new corps, a new regiment, we rather liked it up there, because being new, we were in wartime buildings, huts, and we were not down in the bottom in those old-fashioned Victorian barracks, which I think really they're all right for a very old, established, traditional regiment, but I think for a new, forward, aggressive regiment, I think we were better off and had a better feeling akin to it up there than we would have been if we'd been down in the bottom. It's interesting.
It's sort of symbolic being on top of a hill or something, wasn't it?
Yes. And I say, those old barracks, Victorian barracks, are terribly depressing, I think.
That's interesting. You were there for 3 years, from 27 to 30. Did Perham Down develop very much during that period?
Develop in what way? The only development was, of course, we were getting more equipment. I mean, we had sufficient, but more was coming along. The only big development, I would say, there from the, which I particularly noticed, was the fact that our commanding officer, having been an international England rugby player, he was very keen on playing fields, and so were we all. And we did spend most afternoons working on building up these playing fields. Rugby pitch, football pitches, hockey pitches, levelling out the ground, with the assistance of the Royal Engineers, of course, and experts, but the whole regiment went down to it. And they took a tremendous pride in doing that, and it was a great achievement.
When you first went to Perham Down, what kind of people were joining the battalion as new recruits?
Well, I think we were still getting a lot then. We never suffered from a shortage of recruits, as far as I can recall, in the regiment. But we were getting then a lot more, because there was the, in those 27s, if my memory is right, there was this trouble, not trouble, but there was unemployment in the minefields, especially in South Wales. And we did get a lot of South Wales boys coming up. And jolly good they were, too.
And the young officers like yourself, did they have anything in common?
Well, I think the young officers were about the same, came from public schools. Most of them, of course, came from Sandhurst. I think a territorial army officer is perhaps a rarity. But we were beginning to get the odd then territorial officer, the odd university officer. But of course the main, 90% or 98%, were from Sandhurst.
What about transfers from other regiments? Were there many of those coming in?
Not in the junior ranks. There were, of course, most of your senior officers, that is to say, majors, and some captains too at that time, quite a number were transferred from other regiments.
Mm-hmm. How did you find the quality of the transfers in the more senior positions compared with the quality of the new recruits?
I wouldn't like to answer that one. I find it difficult because when you get down to quality of what? You see, our senior officers then were all ex-wartime soldiers. And so difficult to say quality of those people with their experience with a young chap who's never experienced, only he's experienced it is the rationing.
Well, let me be more specific. Little Hart, in his history of the regiment, says that at this time the Corps was attracting very able young recruits, but that many of the transfers from other regiments had transferred for the wrong kinds of reasons. Like, for example, they didn't see any promotion prospects in their own regiment, so they joined the RTC merely for promotion rather than as a result of any strong interest in the arm. And he claims that this produced a higher quality at the lower officer levels than it did at the higher. Were you aware of that? Or does it not correspond to your experience?
I don't think at that stage that one was really aware of that. One was certainly aware of the fact of the quality of youngster coming in, of the young officer coming in, because being a new regiment, they thought out why they wanted to come in, most of them, and those with, I don't say ambition, but forward-thinking and intelligent, said, we want to start something new, we want to get into something new. You see, and again, and though your senior officers, I don't think, did have the same, perhaps, standard of intellect, one could rudely put it that way, but of course we had a great reverence for them because they were wartime soldiers and had seen active service, which we hadn't. And so consciously, I don't think one would ever think, we ever thought of comparing the intellect of a young officer and the intellect of a senior officer. Does that?
Yes, that's perfectly clear. Now, in the early days at Perham Down, after you first joined, did you get what could be described as a formal, structured training? Before you started routine regimental duties?
Oh, yes. There was well, of course, the year, and I suppose it is still the same now, the year in the regular army is split up into the individual training season, the collective training season. Now, it was far more, in those days, cut and dried, because, of course, the army, either in England or abroad, in the middle, in the 30s or that, in between the wars, really had no commitments. There was no, today, you see, of course, it is not so easy to do that, to split it up evenly.
I'm thinking less of the battalion training and more of your personal training.
Well,
you arrived, you didn't know one end of a tank from the other. How did you acquire the skills that you needed?
Well, then, you see, well, having got your years split up between the two, as a young officer starting off, you, of course, are posted to a company or section, and you take up your normal duties as a regular officer in that section. You then have, during the individual training season, then there are, of course, young officers' courses within the regiment, not outside, in certain aspects of training. You would be in the tank park so many hours per week.
To do what?
Oh, with the fitters and things, to learn all about the tank. You were taken out by senior officers on map reading exercises, tactics, and so on. History. You had lectures in the evening, which is usually run by the second in command. He was usually responsible for the junior officers, the new officers. And then, for after that, after you've been there some time, depending upon the, throughout the corps, the vacancies and so forth, then all the young officers of the tank corps had to go down to Barrington Camp, which was a depot and schools, and you then had to do, and I think they were 3 months, as far as I can remember, 3 months D&M, driving and maintenance course, on armoured cars and tanks, and lorries, where you were taught to drive and to be an instructor in driving. That's the point. They were instructor courses, not just teaching you to drive. They were teaching you to be a driving instructor, teaching you to be a maintenance instructor. And then after that...
Before we go on, I'm interested in what tanks and armoured cars you trained on and how you found them, what your opinion of them was.
Well, the tanks, of course, were the same that we had in the battalion. They were the Vickers Medium, exactly the same. The armoured cars, of course, we didn't have them because we were a tank battalion, not an armoured car battalion. There was only one armoured car battalion, the third, I think. And the armoured cars were Rolls-Royce. But they did have some odd Crossley armoured cars because they were the main... not the main equipment, but they were most of the companies in India had Crossley, so you had to learn that as well as the Rolls. But your main instruction was on the Rolls.
And on the light tanks and the medium tanks, how did you find them? What did you think of
them? Well, we had no light tanks in those days. Light tanks didn't come into until... well, I think the middle 30s.
Yes.
So, of course, there were no light tanks. It was just the medium tanks. Oh, they were tremendous things because, of course, they were so so mobile in comparison to not that we'd driven them, but we'd been over the wartime tanks. Of course, was so slow. I mean, the wartime tanks, great cumbersome things, with no revolving turrets. Maximum speed, I suppose, about 3 miles an hour.
Yes.
Whereas we were doing much more.
What was it like? I mean, how did you find it? What were its idiosyncrasies? Did it seem to be a good machine, or did it have any defects?
Oh, I think in those young days we didn't think very much about. They were efficient machines. They needed a lot of attention, which all had to be given to by the crew.
What things in particular needed a lot of attention?
We did have trouble. I always remember one had to watch very carefully the Rackham steering, because the Ferodo linings, which braked one track so that you turned round, if that went and you braked and there was no brake, well, of course, you finished up in a house or a ditch or anything else. And they used to, but you've got, usually got warning of it, because so often through the heat they would go on, they'd catch fire. And quite often you had to post somebody near them with a fire extinguisher to keep them cool and put out any little smoke. And then you knew when you got back, the barracks, you probably had to reline them.
Mm. Did they have their own sort of idiosyncrasies as well? Things which you would learn only with experience?
Oh, I think like any machine, I think you will always find a driver who knows his machine. It'll go for him, but it won't go for somebody else. And that is, the machine is a very human being. And that is why one always likes to keep your drivers on the one machine, and not change them, like the modern idea of in civil life, the driver just drives any bus he's handed and then goes into workshops. No, the driver must know his machine and get it, because they do have idiosyncrasies. Certain things go wrong, certainly one's handling or playing with. There's no question about that, to my mind.
Mm. You had a gunnery course at Lulworth as well. How was that organised?
The gunnery course was there again. You had down there, you went from Bovington to Lulworth, and there, of course, they had all these miniature ranges, which were tables with simulated tanks, and you had, at the other end, you had the turrets of your medium tanks, mounted on a fixed basis, but they revolved round, you rotated round exactly as though you were in a tank, exactly the same shape and size. In fact, they were old turrets. And alongside the barrel, you had an air rifle. And then targets popped up, and your instructor taught you how to shoot. Follow the target, shoot it. Because in those days, you see, you didn't have the any of these gyroscopic sights and I can't remember the name of the damn things now. You had to, in those days, you had to estimate the range. You had to estimate the speed of the target. It was an enemy vehicle, which is mostly tanks, of course. And then you had to lay off your gun to account for that. So it was rather like throwing a stone in the air, and then you throw another stone at it and see if you can hit it. You had quite a bit of guesswork. And it's amazing how accurate you could become. And then from that, of course, you finished the course by doing live shooting on the ranges.
How did you find personally that the real thing compared with the simulated training?
Oh, without the simulated training, you couldn't. Of course, it was In many ways, it would be quicker to teach a man by putting him straight onto the ranges. But, of course, the expense of the ammunition. And so, of course,
the limited firing exercises you did do after the simulated test, what sort of form did they take?
What we call battle runs. You start off I think we used to start off at 1,000 yards range and come down firing either diagonally, crosswise, or head-on, down to about 500. And you had so many rounds, you had to fire off at 1,000, and then as you went down, and you had to estimate that, because the targets were in different places on the ranges. And they also moved, because the targets were...
How were they organized?
Well, they were organized in the same way. It was on the side of Bindon Hill, and they had a motor and a wire hawser which towed them. Quite often they broke down. but they towed them across your front and went behind bushes and came out again, and that sort of thing. Quite great.